Hello, bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 107 of Little Things for Bonsai People. It is the year 2025. It's the year of the snake. And this time I am joined by my co-host, Carmen Lesko-Bienski. How's it going, Carmen?
Pretty good. How are you, Evan?
I'm doing excellent. I got a lot of good things going on right now. And
yay.
I'm just in a generally great mood, I'm gonna be honest with you. So
nice.
But before I gush too much about how I feel, what's happening in Michigan currently?
Let's see. We are just coming out of a week where most of our overnights were below zero. And it looks like we're going to have like 4 days in the 40s, and I'm thrilled. And then we're going to go back down to the 20s. Yeah. And then we're going to jump into repotting next week. So
cool.
It's a good time.
This is Evan and Carmen's weather alert section that we usually have every episode. Yeah, give us the Morse code going on. The weather here in Southeast Louisiana especially has been really odd. We had snow. How long ago was that? I remember telling you about that. It was like two weeks ago.
That was really cool. It was longer than that, I think.
Maybe almost a month now?
Probably.
I can't remember. Everything's going so fast now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it snowed and then it went into the 80s and 90s the next week. And and everything sprung into action. So we have like buds breaking on trees in the ground and in bonsai pots.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, last night, this happened like a couple weeks after the snow, after it was 90 degrees, we got 25 degrees suddenly for two nights straight.
Oof.
And
yikes.
One of those days between like yesterday and today, it didn't get above 35 degrees. So it's been like a frigid, you know, feels like 32 when the wind's blowing kind of day.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved a lot of stuff into the greenhouse. I was in the middle of repotting for the past 2 weeks. So I've been busting my ass with going and I've repotted everything from like raw stock, pre-bonsai, older bonsai trees, doing maintenance pruning. I've done the works. And then out of nowhere, cold weather. So everything went in the greenhouse. And then we got this cold weather to kind of slow things down. And now, technically, our repotting season has been extended out like another week because everything kind of like slowed down for a minute and is picking back up. So
that's cool. Yeah, we've got, I was telling you through text earlier this week, we've got some of our younger azaleas. So there's, you know, we've got the big old ones that are just kind of sitting, but like we've got a couple forest plantings that are younger stock. And they're starting to push vegetative growth already. And then I've seen too on some of the older azaleas, maybe not the oldest ones, but there's a little bit of back budding starting on a few of them. And like the elms, there you can see the buds swelling, and this is all in cold storage. So, you know, everything's still protected and we're trying to keep it cool, but
it's ready to go.
It's like if we get enough heat, we're going to have a little bit of an early season. So I might be adjusting some temperature controls to see if I can keep it a little bit cooler in there.
Without the luxury of having like a big control, we talked about greenhouses and cold frames, and we don't have anything like that here at the nursery. So it's kind of been touch and go, move everything, you know, be very selective. So at my house, by the way, I repotted probably a dozen of my personal trees and then another handful of my trees just started budding out. So I had about 20 trees in my house on my kitchen table last night.
Oh my gosh.
And I had collected trees. I pulled trees out of the ground that I was like really iffy about. Like I had a American elm that I'm starting to think is a hop hornbeam now because I think I misidentified it, but that's another story. And then a water elm that I've been growing from cutting for myself for about 4 years. I pulled those out of the ground and they came in my house as well. So there's just a couple of different things going on there, but all my repots, like this is the thing though, that about spring is that this is a really exciting time of the year because I get to change containers on trees. I get to put trees into containers for the first time because I'm making trees from raw stock a lot over here where I'm at. And then those trees are starting to move and like are starting to move forward. Motion's starting to happen. You know, buds are starting to pop on everything. So this is a really exciting time of the year for a lot of bonsai people. And if anyone's been listening to us, how long have we been doing this for now?
I think this is our third spring.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
happy anniversary of the third spring with the Little Things. Woo! If you guys had listened to us for that long, we have arrived. Welcome to the third spring of the Little Things for Bonsai People podcast and the chaos that it ensues. So in relevance to the spring and going into this new season and the new year of our show, we're going to talk about something a little bit more related to science. Today is a science episode, and today I'm gonna let Carmen kind of break it down because I presented an idea to her about talking about the mechanisms in plants when it comes to new growth and how energy is used, and she went on another tangent and talked about flowers. So Carmen, tell us about what we're talking about today, so I get a little bit better information.
Yeah, my bad. I had, when Evan presented the idea to me, I somehow stuck on the mention of like flower bud differentiation. So I kind of went on a deep dive into flower formation, how that happens, and then, which is actually similar to a lot of other processes within the plant as far as how different structures form. And then beyond flower bud differentiation and formation, you know, what makes a plant flower? Like what outside of the plant, what environmental factors can influence flowering or cause flowering and that sort of thing. So yeah, we'll talk about pretty flowers today. And Evan, you had a, you know, an interesting add-on of benefits of growing flowering trees or shrubs or as bonsai, and you know why those are good to grow, or you know what makes them different from just the trees that you're, you know, just looking for foliage. So
yeah. And talk about their place in the bonsai garden and the bonsai culture, as far as that goes, as far as flowering plants. I mean, spring feels like an appropriate time to talk about that. So awesome. I'm glad we came to this agreement.
Yes.
Like organically, we were like, what's the topic? And you were like, I got this. And I was like, oh, okay, we'll do that. Like, whoops. Anyway, that's how things work on the show. So if this is your first time listening, we're sorry, but we're also not sorry because this is just the way things are. But before we get too much further, we do need to mention that this show is sponsored by our amazing patrons over on patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. You can head on over to that website and become a patron and become a best bud or a specimen best bud and support the little things, support the little things in life that matter, like bonsai and me and Carmen. We're not little people, but there are little things we have to worry about in our life. I don't know where I was going with that, but
I am short.
Yeah.
So well, there's that.
I mean, I'm pretty average. I mean, I'm like, I'm barely 5'9". So
you're
I think
taller than me. So
hardly
you're tall.
Yeah. I'm very average in height. So besides that, we do have a featured best bud. We always shout out our best bud feature at the beginning of every episode, and then we read off our list at the end. We have been kind of switching up where if we have a guest artist on, and I don't want to put them through reading off all the people, I apologize. But when it's just me and Carmen, we have fun with it. So we'll read off all the best buds at the end of each episode. But our featured best bud today is Chantel Nguyen. She's sponsored our show for several months, even I think up to 2 years now. And she is one of my really good friends' wife, and she is also a good friend of mine as well. So thank you, Chantel, so much for sponsoring our show at the $5 level. Really, really helps. And of course, we have our specimen best buds that get shout outs every single time at the beginning. Unryuin Bonsai Garden in Australia. Thank you, Rick. And Bill Butler of Bill's Bayou. I switched you up, Bill. You're supposed to be the anchor best bud. I'm sorry. I forgot. I just remembered just now when I said it, I was like, wait, something's not right about that. I'm so used to saying Bill at the end. Bill, for you, Bill, I'm going to switch it up. Sorry, buddy. We'll get it right. Mark McWilliams is our next one, our next specimen best bud. Thank you so much. And then J. David Tolbert. And then, of course, Bill Butler, you're our anchor. So thank you so much, guys, sponsoring at the $30 level. That is amazing. That really, really goes a long ways. It lets us do things like do our Little Things scholarship that we handed out not too long ago in episode 100. It lets us do things like print really funny T-shirts that we could sell at conventions. It lets us do things like hang out, go to conventions and afford to do those things and do some extra things. When we see a bonsai best bud or a specimen bud at a convention, if you're hanging out, we want to hang out with you. We'll go to lunch, take you to lunch. You know, if you got a tree with you, we'll work on a tree with you. You know, whatever you guys want. We really appreciate you guys, and y'all make this so much richer. So thank you guys for sponsoring the show. And also, as far as our main show sponsor, we have Joshua Roth Tools. Thank you, John and Joshua Roth Tools, for supporting the show. And of course, Underhill Bonsai. I support my own show. That shouldn't be a surprise. And we can't go much further without mentioning, oh, the great, oh, the one and only Matt O'Donnell, the editor. He makes us sound smart. He cleans up our audio and makes us enjoyable to listen to. You can go over to mattodonnell.com and fill out a contact form to start your own podcast show with him or an audio engineering project. He is a set bassist living in Nashville, Tennessee. He's an all-around awesome guy in the script every time. Said it. Okay. And then we have a couple of other announcements real quick.
Oh, we do?
Yeah.
Oh, I have a question.
Okay. What is your question?
Are there going to be T-shirts that say bonsai?
That was one of my announcements. So thanks for stepping on me on that.
Oh, sorry. Okay. You can edit that out, Matt.
No. Don't edit it out. It's coming. It's coming. You just didn't give me time. Jumped the gun on it.
Sorry. I'm just so excited. I need more T-shirts.
It's okay. Let me mention first, before we talk about the T-shirts, we'll push that back a little bit.
Okay.
I will be going to the 2025 Festival and World Bonsai Day. That's going to be the Potomac Bonsai Festival in... at the National Bonsai Impinging Museum, May 9th through the 11th. The featured artists will be Guy Guidry and Andrew Robson. They will be working and doing their own separate demos. I will be hanging out with Guy. I don't want to spoil too much on that. I've talked to Carmen about this. She's aware of what's happening. But I will be there. And Guy's a good friend of mine, so you should be able to put those things together. And then there's a list of vendors here. And it's so funny because I know a lot of these people and seen them so often. So I'll try my best with some of these names. Some should be fine. So vendors that will be there. If you're in the DC area and you love the National Pinjing and Bonsai Museum and you will be around in May, this is going to be a great opportunity to go see beautiful bonsai in addition to their own separate bonsai display that they're going to have in the pavilion. They've been allowed a space in the courtyard pavilion area to set up more bonsai from the local clubs to show off their trees. And the vendors include artist Arleta Kardar. I don't know what I tried my best. You know how I am with pronouncing things. The Bonsai Learning Center, Greenwich Gardens, and Greenwich is one of our bonsai best buds. Thank you. Hollow Work Ceramics, Ironwood Bonsai Studio, Kusa Farm, Young Cho Kusumono. I see Young everywhere. I made a joke about that, but there she is again. Nihon's Miniatures, Nature's Way Nursery, North American Satsuki Bonsai Center. Know a lot about them. Oki Bonsai, Rocks, Pots, and Plants, School of Fish Prints, Waldo Street Pottery. I'm going to have Eli at Say Bonsai, by the way. Eli Atkins, Waldo Street. And then the PBA members sales table, items for sale by the PBA, which is the Potomac Bonsai Association. And then there's going to be all kinds of lectures and demonstrations. There's going to be beginners workshops. There's going to be a children's learning center area for bonsai. It's going to be amazing. You know, this is going to be really, really cool. And I will be up there. So if you guys are in the area and attending that festival, that World Day Bonsai Festival, come say hey. I'll be hanging out and having a great time. That's one of the things that put me in a great mood is I got more information about it. And I'm actually able to announce that festival now that I have all the information I need on it. So awesome.
Cool.
And then, yeah, of course, Say Bonsai. That's going to be our most pressing thing that's on my mind and work that we're working on now. So another thing that I'm happy about is that I'm lining a lot of my vendors up. I have a full vendor list for Say Bonsai. I don't want to go through all that. I just said vendors on the other thing just now. But yes, Carmen, you mentioned that you were looking for shirts and asking about shirts, right? So we are running the flagship shirt of I went to a bonsai workshop and all I got was this stump shirt. It's going to be on a like stonewashed looking tie-dye shirt this time.
That's cool.
And so we're going to run that shirt again in a big quantity. And then we're also collaborating with Unhallowed Design. So Jonathan Wagner, he's a good buddy of mine. He prints all my shirts and he's a little bit of a metalhead and a little bit of a alternative style type guy. He likes making really cool graphic designs for bands and stuff. And so me and him put our heads together and we got a really nice little things, collaborative design with Unhallowed Designs that we're going to have exclusive for Say Bonsai this year. So it's going to be a really, really cool little exclusive thing that we're going to have. You can only get those shirts at Say Bonsai. So if you're coming down to hang out with us March 28th, 29th, and the 30th, you can hang out with me, Mike, Carmen, of course, and then Guy Guidry, Randy Bennett, Dawn Ketting, Sylvia Smith, and Julian Tsai. So we got some really, really great bonsai artists going to be in town. We're going to have demos and lectures all day. Jazz music has been confirmed. I've got jazz musicians. We got a pulse on jazz musicians going to be playing at our show as well as the meet and greet. We're going to have some chill jazz vibes going on there as well, provided by a couple of New Orleans musicians. And then we're going to have Boiled Crawfish is confirmed too. So, I mean, that was something that was on my mind. It's another thing that's kind of lifted me up a little bit. I'm like, cool, I got the crawfish padded down. Like it's because this time of year for March, like early March, is usually pretty chaotic trying to get that kind of stuff set up. So a lot of people have weddings and stuff during that time. So renting those the accommodations for like the tent and the crawfish and the jazz musicians, it's kind of like a wedding reception with bonsai in it is what it sounds like in a way as we're working with people. So but yeah, everything's lining up very nicely. So yeah, that's going to be a really good time. So if you guys are in town, definitely, like in the Folsom in Southeast Louisiana, we got people coming in from Texas and Florida and Alabama, even our Oklahoma guys that we talked to, Austin Atkins. I talked to him, you know, we've featured his club a few times and kind of brought up about these guys reviving their club in their area, which is beautiful. So yeah, we can't wait to see everybody. It's going to be a really good time. And yeah. Did you have anything going on in your part of the world?
Yeah, actually, I am, let's see, Say Bonsai is in March. Then in April, I will be at the, oh my gosh, hold on. It's in Sacramento. I'm going to Sacramento, California, headlining a show out there. I think it's, I'm trying to remember the acronym. I can never remember the acronym. But I'll be in Sacramento, April. Let me pull up the dates again because I was not prepared as usual. April 12th and 13th, I will be headlining a show out in San Francisco doing some demos. So if you're in that area, come on up or down or over or whatever and see me there. And then super excited to announce that May 10th and 11th, I will be headlining the Michigan All-State Bonsai Show at Frederick Meyer Gardens. So I'll be judging, doing demos and workshops there. So if you're in the Michigan Great Lakes region, you can come see me there.
Yeah. And that's kind of funny because the May, that's the World Day Bonsai.
World Bonsai Day.
Yeah. That's like the whole weekend. So if you're not in DC, go see Carmen in Michigan. But if you're in DC, come see me. So we'll see what happens. And if you're, I mean, if you're just in your part of the world, just hang out. You don't have to go, you have to fly all over the world just to see us. That's, but apparently we're doing a lot of stuff because we're going to be all over the place. And everybody knows about the BSF. We talked about that, Bonsai Societies of Florida show. We talked about that with Rob Kempinski, the whole thing on that last episode with me and Rob. So yeah, lots of really good stuff going on. And this is the first part of the year, you know, not to mention that, we're going to try for nationals this year, but we'll see. So anyway,
well, I'll be there at least.
Yeah, so. You'll be there. I'm when I say we're going to try, you know, Carmen's already. Yeah,
I'm going to be there.
You've got trees that kind of take precedence over some other trees that go there. Whereas some of us have to try a little bit harder. I'm just joking. But anyway, so I'm hoping for the best. I contacted Bill a while back, but you know, it those who have submitted trees to the national show know that the process takes a long time to get going. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're hoping.
Do you know the deadline for submitting trees to nationals?
I'm not really sure at the moment.
Okay.
You can go on the website. Yeah. If you look up the National Show 2025, and it'll be there. I can't remember. It's usually by that cutoff date that I think that's around the time when he really seriously starts looking at that stuff. So even if he didn't mm-hmm. respond to you, my experience is that if you just send him a reminder email and be like, hey, I sent you a thing, and a couple of submissions a little while back, then, you know, I don't know. You don't want to push people in there. Like right now, like when I'm planning, say, Bonsai, like it's pretty stressful getting all that together. So I can understand.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, Bill's been running the show since 2009, I think, or 2008, something like that. So it's a lot of work. So, but yeah, lots and lots of events going on this year. I joke about how I wasn't going to schedule a lot out this year because I have Rory now and all the stuff that's going on there. And I'm just like, well, this is kind of how things lined up. So we'll see. It's going to be a good year. So for flowers on trees, so I'll let you kind of break into it because I think one of the original questions was like, whenever a tree uses its resources, the stored starches and sugars that it created through photosynthesis. We talked through on the previous science episodes about that type of stuff, correct? Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of working around and, you know, I was thinking about like the way that, you know, how does auxin release our chemical? Like, I think we might've brought that up in one of the previous ones too. How does that interact with the mm-hmm. extensions? And then you mentioned flowers, which is probably a little bit more interesting than talking about how like leaves extend out and how internode spacing works, because they also play into flowers, correct? So kind of give mm-hmm. us a soft break into that.
Yeah, I didn't include too much about the different hormones involved, but I could talk a little bit kind of about how flower buds, you know, are formed and what that process looks like. So, you know, similarly to how a leaf forms or a stem grows or a root forms, there's this like group of cells at the tip of the shoot. They're called meristematic cells, and they're kind of like our human stem cells. They're able to turn into whatever kind of cell they need to turn into for that structure. And so for flowers, like at the shoot's tip or where a leaf is going to form, there are some of these kind of meristematic cells that, based on the processes happening within the plant, will then start to turn into flower buds for the following year, right? So there's two stages of this. There's induction of the flower bud and then development of the flower bud. And so the induction is this part that you don't see. This is the physiological part that happens inside the cells where they're gathering the resources and the hormones are affecting them and all this other stuff that kind of has to come to this space in order to do that. And then the development, this is stage two, is, you know, the morphological part of it where you see physically the bud forming and how it develops after all this stuff happens at a cellular level. And so that can also be, you know, changed based on the hormones within the plant. And then external things like plant nutrition, the environment that it's in, all of this stuff will affect those different processes, like almost any process within the plant. So yeah, that's kind of the general breakdown of it.
Mm-hmm.
Questions.
Yeah. So
it's a lot really fast.
Yeah. There's a lot of things that like I can't really just take it all in one mm-hmm. bite. It's kind of like, mm-hmm. okay. It did bring up some stuff like you said that the flowers will set that they will set up the process before the flowers are even present.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting.
So it's like the beginning of a physiological process, and then they don't really, you know, develop stuff until they have whatever is there.
And that kind of makes me think of like the whole thing. It's, you know, when you're pruning some trees that are you want the flowers to develop. And so I feel like this also can kind of help me comprehend a little bit, like you play with a lot of azaleas and,
oh, yeah,
and trimming techniques on them to promote as much flowering as possible, or to dial it back, because sometimes, from my understanding, it can go a little too hard sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way you prune them, because you understand that process of how it's going to develop those new buds, does that help you plan out the pruning process on azaleas better in that way?
Less so the actual formation of flower buds, but I guess more so there's a couple different ways that plants can flower. And I had written a note about this because I wanted to bring it up. So I'm glad that you're talking about it. But there are some plants that flower on like new growth, and there are some plants that flower on old growth. So this means like, okay, if you have grown, for example, a hydrangea, climbing hydrangea, let's use that one, or an apple, right? So those buds form, those flower buds form in the summertime, like right after they bloom. So if you wait to prune that until the fall or this following spring, you're going to cut off your flower buds because those flower buds have formed on the older wood, right? So, but there's other stuff that flowers on the new growth. So, you know, the shoot grows, extends, and then the flowers off of that shoot. So you can prune whenever, the flower buds are going to form later on the regrowth, and then you don't have as big of an issue. So with the azaleas, I need to double check my definition of old and new, because technically they flower, like if I were to prune an azalea overall right now, I would cut off all the flower buds. So I have to selectively prune so I can thin it without cutting off the flower buds. So knowing when the flower buds form is when a plant flowers does affect how I prune, but less so the actual physiological process of the bud forming.
And so I guess in a way it's, I'm trying to think of like example, like I've been working with the huckleberries that I've sent you mm-hmm. pictures of recently, and I was approaching things a little bit differently, and I ended up not pruning as much as I used to on that mm-hmm. one particular one that's flowering like crazy. So that would have been one that process would happen on an older piece of mm-hmm. growth. And
yeah.
And I am still not cued in on how to encourage, you know, like for instance, we talked about wisterias a while back, like how to encourage mm-hmm. them to flower more. And that's something that other people struggle with. And it's like, whereas like another plant that I could relate to that's the opposite is like a crepe myrtle, where I've mm-hmm. pruned the crap out of them to make them stop flowering, and they keep flowering and they don't stop. So that's one that fights you over and over again, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of understanding how and why. That's mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons why we kind of go in these topics a little bit more. It's like, maybe if we broke down the processes, it could give us a little bit more why and be a little bit less challenging. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it doesn't matter all that much. Whenever it comes to pruning, maybe we're overthinking it a little much on some species, because they will readily bud for us, like the azaleas we were just talking about. So I don't know. I just wanted to see, and is there like a list of plants that we need to think about? Because you mentioned apples, right?
Yeah.
And is that another reason why they seem to be, do they tend to be longer branches and stuff
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, if you want your apple to bloom well in the spring, you have to keep the flower buds that have formed on the growth the previous year, which means you're not going to have necessarily a very tight, well-developed canopy, right? So unless you already have a lot of ramification and your extensions are already relatively short. If you prune your apples early, like right after they bloom-ish, once they bloom, because usually their flowers come out really before their extensions. So they bloom, they extend, and you cut them back early in the season, you're going to develop and be able to maintain likely more flower buds. If you let it grow all season, cut it hard in the fall, you probably are cutting off your blooms. So, and that's like a hydrangea, or it sounds like maybe a huckleberry. If you wait until the fall or winter to do some of that pruning, you're likely cutting off your buds for the following spring because it doesn't have time to regrow and reestablish the flower buds for, you know, that year because it's dormant. This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
Hey guys, it's Evan with Underhill Bonsai, and I just want to tell you guys about Say Bonsai. It's going to be happening from March 28th to the 30th, 2025. We're going to be everything Louisiana for a full weekend, so we're going to include a crawfish boil, homemade gumbo, and other food trucks and vendors that are very special, I guess you can say, the southern culture of Louisiana. And also, the show will include a bonsai show with its own special awards, including Best in Show, Best Shohin, Best Traditional Design, People's Choice Award, and also a tongue-in-cheek Best Bald Cypress Bonsai Award. Guest artists and visiting artists will include Julian Tsai, Sylvia Smith, Mike Lane, Carmen Lesko-Bianski, Dawn Ketting, Randy Bennett, and Guy Guidry. Each artist will be presenting demonstrations and giving workshops throughout the weekend. You can go over to underhillbonsaistore.com and go under our Save Bonsai Workshops tab, and you can sign up for just regular attendance. It's going to be $25 just to get into the exhibit tent, and then all the workshops will be spaced out, and they will all have individual pricing. We hope to see you guys there.
And so walk us through the formation of the flowers then, because I feel like that's where you were kind of going with it.
Yeah, that was the you know, the real scientific part of it, was that physiological process. So like I mentioned, it's the same kind of cells that are in, you know, all of the growing tips of the plant, the meristematic cells. And there's the two parts. The first part is the induction, where it's like preparing everything, and then the actual formation of the bud, that's the physical, you know, growth, and all of the pieces of the flower are there essentially and overwintering most of the time, with woody plants, with bonsai. So like all of the, if you were to take an azalea bud right now and cut it open, you would see, you know, the different layers of petals, and then, you know, kind of a preformed stigma and ovary and that kind of stuff. So it's all there in that bud. It just has to open and expand when the plant actually blooms. So, which is really interesting if you think about it. It's not just a little bundle of cells. It's like, it's all there. It's just really tiny. It's like when you cut open like a seed and you can see like the little leaf in there just kind of waiting to, like a peanut. If you're ever eating a peanut, or it falls in half, and you can kind of actually see where like the little leaf would be if you let it grow.
And yeah, that's kind of like the same thing with like the with buds, just like a regular leaf bud. Because one of the things that I've seen too is like on like my sweet gum, like I have sweet gum, and there's in that species in particular has a more coarse growth in a and bud extension on them, and you can see it. It's almost like you're getting a magnified view of it to begin with. And because elm trees and other maples, like there's the Trident maple is kind of another example of a really, really small bud as compared to a sweet gum, where you can literally see the tiny, tiny little leaves just kind of chilling in there waiting.
Mm-hmm. Just yeah, like a beech. If you see that they've got the big, long, extended bud, and if you were to cut that open or dissect it, you would see the leaf in there curled up. It just hasn't grown out yet.
So it's just prepared. It just hasn't had the energy pumped into it. So it's kind of like, I don't mean to be kind of just like straightforward and goofy with it. It's almost like if you were to take like an air pump and pump and put
because actually, it's
pressure.
Yeah. A lot of cell. And actually that's a lot of how plants grow is like they have the cells formed. They just haven't elongated yet. So you're not necessarily adding a lot of mass to those cells. You're mostly just like stretching them out with water. So like once those resources go there, they expand, but you know, all the building blocks are already there. It's like kind of a minimal amount of building at that point and more of just like a, essentially it's like a water pump, you know, it's like filling up a water balloon.
It's something else that, it does relate to the growth as well is that it's called Tugger pressure.
Turger.
Mm-hmm. Turger. I say Tugger. I know somebody with the last name of Tugger. That's why I get it confused. but Turger pressure has to do with a lot with extension. And so it does actually interact with flowers as well. That's why I've seen azaleas do this where they're pumping really hard to put out all these new growth and the flowers are doing their thing. And then if you get underwater, then everything just gets droopy and sad. And normally that messes like the whole thing up, really. And,
it you can. Know, yeah.
Cause then even if you do water after that point, there's a lot of the vascular system and the capillaries and the petals themselves get damaged from that, right?
It's almost like freezing, because when you freeze a cell, right, the cell wall breaks or whatever, it becomes unusable essentially. But with wilting of flowers like that, if there's not enough water to hold that Turger pressure, the cell can die or become, you know, not actually, it doesn't hold its shape and it might not get that shape back. It's completely messed up. So yeah, exactly. It's kind of like it's not quite burning, but it's very much like freezing in that there's enough physical damage to the cell that it can't regain its structure if it's gotten too dry.
Yeah. And so during flowering, on bonsai, would you say that watering is going to change during that? If you were to, I know with that, and I keep alluding back to the azaleas because they are a great example of this because they can flower heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And so is water intake higher or is it the same? How does this affect it overall?
You know, I haven't really noticed them drying out faster when they're blooming yeah, I guess they do dry out faster than midsummer because they're also actively growing usually when they're also blooming. But I haven't noticed a huge, it's not out of control. Like it feels manageable. It's a lot of water, but it's not like, oh my God, I have to water them every 5 seconds. You know, it's, you just, because it's spring, you just kind of have to water them more anyway. So I haven't really noticed a huge, you know, amount of additional water uptake when something flowers.
Yeah. And so as far as the flowering of different plants go, this is something that I'm starting to get into a little bit more because I remember I got really excited about deciduous hollies. I think it was yesterday I discovered that we have them in the field all along. And I had misidentified them. And so when I was looking further into them in there, one of those plants that like one will flower a male flower and one will flower a female part of it. And and so one of them has the ovary and one doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But the flowers look very, very similar. Whereas, and this is going to be this is Ilex decidua, the possum haw or deciduous holly of the American South area. It has a pretty broad range, so it might even exist in, you know, upstate stuff, like in the different areas, like past the midline. It might even be up where you're at. I'm not sure. But the flower has that look where it's like, it looks like a little rose kind of four petal, like hollies, you know, they're not very distinct flowers. It's not like something that you get the tree for.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to talk about like a little bit later on once we get through the physiology and the processes of and the why and how of flowers, about how I think that's actually a load of crap that you would not use a holly for flowering purposes too. They actually, it can
they're
be
interesting. They're not showy, but they're kind of, it's kind of cool. Like
it's
especially
there.
The buds, they're like on the hollies that I've used, the verticillata and the japonica. Not
what was the cerata?
Cerata, you know, their buds are kind of a bluish purplish color and they're in little clusters, so that they're very pretty even though the flowers themselves aren't like super showy.
It's a multi-interest like multi-seasonal interest plant at that point, in my opinion. But before we get too far to that, I wanted to, that's what I get excited about whenever I find plants that are like that. That's why when I found those deciduous hollies, like the deciduous hollies, I was like, this is a next level thing for me. It makes me excited. But anyway, so like the ovary of the holly flowers, the flowers are just so small. Mm-hmm. If you look really close, that ovary part is like a round little, I don't know if it's, you know, too straightforward to say it's like a little ball that kind of sits in the center, and it will also tell you like that basically turns into the fruit, which if you just really make it simplistic, it's like reproduction, just like how like most living organisms that have like an ovary and the stomata and the ovary sections, some plants can do both systems too, which is kind of interesting, but that makes a unique challenge because then when you have the male and the female flower, you have to be very, very specified about, okay, so I have the female deciduous holly. I have to make sure that I live in an area where they're native enough for the pollinators to get to it, or I have to figure out another game plan to have that other guy, the guy and the lady trees next to each other. So so there's a possibility that will happen. And I was going to kind of go into that question too, is like, this is just theoretical. And I'm sure some people wonder this. I wonder this personally, because I mean, this is how my brain works. So if I have two hollies, will the pollinator do the job enough that like, they'll go over there and they'll make the fruit on the entire tree? Is that something I should rely on or no?
I don't know the exact mechanism for the pollination of hollies. I think it might be a wind pollinated one. So proximity is important.
That's interesting.
I don't remember seeing, it doesn't mean there aren't, but I don't remember specifically seeing bees or flies or any other kind of aerial pollinator on them when they're blooming. So it may just be an air pollinated one, but it is super important. Like back in Portland, we'd have the females on the bench and we'd pull the males out when everybody was flowering and just kind of stick the males on the bench around the females and cross our fingers. And that usually works. Before we had any male hollies in the yard, we took them over to Andrew's house and we're like, here, Andrew, will you keep these for a week while they're flowering so that they get berries? Cause he had a male in his yard.
Interesting.
So, yeah, in that case, I think it's a lot more wind pollinated. And I think a lot of the plants that are that have the male and the female parts on separate flowers are probably mostly wind pollinated. Some plants will have the male flowers and the female flowers on the same plant, but conifers will do this. You'll have the pine cone with the seeds is actually the female flower. Then there's pollen cones that are totally separate that look a little bit different, but they're usually, the tree will usually have both on the same tree. But the holly is one where the female flower is only on one tree and the male flower is only on a different tree. It doesn't have both of the flowers on the same tree. So, yeah.
Plants are weird.
They're real weird. But like, I guess if you think about it, like kind of makes sense when you think about like how plants evolved. Like the conifers had this two flower system, but they had to have the flowers mostly on the same tree, right? But then like it makes a lot more sense for like all the herbaceous plants in general. I mean, not all of them, but in general, they have all the flower parts, male and female, in one flower on one plant. So they can like, you know, it's a much easier process.
It's so weird because when, because I've watched like a lot of the David Attenborough. Is that his name?
Attenborough. Yeah. David Attenborough.
And I can hear his voice in the back of my head right now. We're talking about flowers and pollination. And I'm imagining there's a plant documentary that's really cool. It's called, is it The Private Life? I think it's The Private Life of Plants.
That sounds dirty enough. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like one of the dirty. It's one of those ones where it's like it talks about the reproduction mechanisms of plants in particular because of the way that the they'll trick bees into like going into the flowers and pollinating.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah, there's like specific orchids that have evolved over time. I can like geek out on this for ages. But yeah, there's like specific orchids that have evolved over time to mimic the female of one species of bee, and so that particular bee thinks that flower is a lady and goes and pollinates the flower mistakenly. But like if that bee dies, like if that species goes extinct, then the orchid will also go extinct because they've co-evolved together and there's not anything else that's going to pollinate it. So like it just blows your mind how specific some of these pollinator mechanisms have become. But it also makes sense as to why some plants are much more prolific than others, you know, like dandelions, they're easy, like no problem. This weird bee pollinated orchid, not so easy.
Rare. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then these plants, it's like a survival of the fittest type thing, but they're plants. So it's a little bit, they have things a little bit easier. There's a lot more of them than we realize. And their means of, you know, procreating and spreading is pretty advanced when it comes.
Oh, yeah.
That's what makes me so intrigued by the flowering process and the pollinators. And when you say there's like windborne pollination, I'm like, oh, well, that's one of the easiest ways to do it. You just kind of scatter your stuff everywhere and you're just like, cool, good luck. Whereas like some plants, you know, they have, like you said, that the orchid requires that particular insect to interact with it. So
it's crazy. And yeah, and like there's some flowers even that, like, you know, when they're kind of expanding, they haven't opened up, but they're all swelling, like they release their pollen at that point before the flower even opens. So they self-pollinate themselves before the flower even opens. So it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But you know, that kind of reduces the genetic variation because they're pollinating themselves. So
that's interesting, you know, too.
Sometimes it can still be a pollen from a different flower that does it, but yeah,
so
it's weird.
I'll go back on what you just said, because that makes me think about there's a Japanese black pine article that I read in an old Bonsai Today magazine that has relevance to the self-pollination and the mother plant thing. But the documentary I was thinking of is actually called Plants Behaving Badly.
Ooh.
With David Attenborough. And
I haven't seen that. I'm going to have to watch that.
That one, it's a two-parter. So one is the one where it's plants tricking pollinators and insects into doing certain tasks for them to achieve their production, the reproduction. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is about carnivorous plants.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
their mechanisms in tricking bugs in different ways. And also using bugs to basically survive, there's these certain pitchers that like trap minnows like inside of them to help break down like organic materials and stuff so they can survive. And there's like a code.
Yeah, that's like a whole other layer of
like the why and how. Yeah, it's
yeah,
because
like the pitcher plant's not eating the minnow or the bugs, it's housing the minnow, which then eats the bugs, and then it's like essentially an aquaponic system because the
waste
from the minnow. Yeah,
I don't think it's a pitcher plant. I think it's a spider wart. I think is what they're called. No, it's not spider wart.
It might be one of the tropical pitcher plants that have the real big pitchers. I don't know.
Now I'm on this whole
I know. I'm like, I want to tell you about skunk cabbage now. Do you guys have skunk cabbage down there? Probably
no,
not.
No, we don't. Is that a native?
It's a native to in the north anyway. It blooms in like March, but like when it flowers, there's enough heat generated to melt the snow around it.
Oh, wow.
So it flowers and then it's like the only thing blooming. So smells. So then the flies go to it and it's like, oh, it's warm.
It's like
it's
a carry
stinky.
On.
Yeah. And so then they get pollinated really early when there's no competition, but like skunk cabbage is cool.
Yeah. Now I love little weird plants that do their own thing and they've evolved for so long now to do those really particular things. They're like, like, why does it happen? It's just been like that for thousands of years like that. And that kind of leads me back to the thing where it's like, so the pine trees that self-pollinate, there was the Bonsai Today article. This is something that this was a conversation with Jonas Dupuis that was like a while back where we had mentioned about two articles that he references a lot from the early days of Bonsai Today, where they talk about this one bonsai artist or nurseryman, because we talked about the separation of nurseryman versus artist on early episodes. If you want some of that, I can't remember what episode we've talked on that on, but there is a craft in the way that bonsai nurseryman will find and seek out Japanese black pine, for instance. Like, this is what this gentleman was doing in Japan. He would go to his forested areas where Japanese black pine are native to him, and he would go underneath the trees that he favored their growth habit and would collect seedlings from those sites to start developing his stock that he would, you know, kind of go through the whole process because developing black pine is a processes on its own, because you want straight needle, short internodes, good bark characteristics, and so on and so forth. And we've talked about variants even in, like, we're starting to see it a lot more when people collect ponderosa pine trees that you see all kinds of variants. I mean, like that one where I was at the ABS show with you and we saw five different pine trees with five different genetics and they were the same species. So this guy in particular, he was going out and finding these trees and they're self-pollinating, I'm guessing, with the Japanese black pine. So he knows it's going to guarantee that will give him that result. And I didn't even realize that. I never thought about that, because I feel like some like conifers, like evergreen junipers and pine trees and the whatnot, they will probably have to self-pollinate because of isolation can happen sometimes with them. You think, is that an evolution?
Yes. because they can be very isolated, or, I mean, conifers developed before flowering plants. So, like, I think it's just an older mechanism, and they're generally wind or air pollinated. So, again, probably because I don't know how many animals were actually around to pollinate back when they started developing.
That's so part of it.
I think there's like some evolutionary reasons, and then some. Yeah, even if they're isolated, it means they can still get pollinated. They're not relying on anything or anybody else to do it for them. So, yeah, that does make sense.
Yeah. And so we'll circle all the way back around to an azalea question that made me kind of ponder this whole thing, because we went through like the development and how this is happening and the why and the how. It's kind of treading around in there, is that with the azaleas, it's so they flower a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm wondering if you had any kind of like idea on like why some plants will choose to flower, not choose, but like it's part of their evolution. Why have they evolved to flower more prolifically, like an azalea is bright, rather than inconspicuous flowering plants? Like, is there a reason, or?
I think it mostly depends on the pollinator. So like, if you look at azaleas in the wild, they're still really showy. But they are, I mean, the cultivated varieties are twice as showy because they've then been bred for that trait. But even in the wild, the azaleas are pretty showy. And generally, that's to get the attention of pollinators. And I feel like a plant that, you know, the more flowers they have, the more chances they get to reproduce. So if you can have a bunch of flowers, you know, that's much, much better for statistics than if you have just one or two flowers.
Yeah. And I mean, we've kind of talked us ourselves into this spot now where it's like, obviously plants flower and want to reproduce and do that kind of stuff for survival measures. And so when it comes to how those flowers interact, and then, you know, we talked about how there's the male and the female, and then there's the ones that have the same ones, and sometimes there's different. I like the story about how you have to move trees over to someone else's collection just to just to find us, like, let's say, like, this episode might be pushing PG-13. We could find a stud for your
That's what they call them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's
a stud plant.
It's just kind of, yeah, it's funny to me. So so inconspicuous flowering and stuff, that's something we'll kind of go into the uses of flowers in bonsai now. I mean, it's something we can talk a little bit more on without having to get too deep dive into, like, the, you know, the sciencey part of it. Is the ink, like, whenever I read up about a particular tree, like when I go back to the deciduous hollies, and I always go on these websites and I read about information, like I try to usually absorb as much information as I can get, like, I look at different, like, things online where, like, if someone's growing them in Louisiana, someone's growing them in Tennessee, someone's growing them in like North Texas or something, like, I want to see all the different ranges and what they have to say about that plant to see if there's any other environmental factor things to consider about the plant for as far as its growth and how to get it to do certain things. Like, flowering is obviously the topic here. Mm-hmm. And I never like to read where it says inconspicuous on flowering. Because I don't really think that's the right way to go about it, because we should be able to recognize that as, like, a feature, because all plants do that to a certain extent. Like, junipers even have their pseudo-pollinator, and then they make little berries on some varieties. Like, the pseudo-flower, it is a pollinator, though. Like, green mounds are really good at doing that. Seen that on, like, Procommons is a really, really strong flower on that tree in particular. It doesn't even look like a flower. It just looks like a little...
Well, yeah, technically it's a cone, not a... Because, yeah, technically conifers don't flower. They have cones.
They cone.
But it's essentially...
The same
thing,
it's
very similar male-female parts, pollen, you know.
Yeah. But obviously if it's more showy, then they will consider it to be of importance for that tree. And we're talking about horticultural, versus... aesthetic in, like, a landscape. So a lot of these websites that I read online, it's like they're considering, it's like, why would you plant this in your yard if it doesn't give you a showy flower? So it's quote unquote inconspicuous. But when we break it down to a bonsai, it's much more obvious, in my opinion.
It's very conspicuous. Yeah. Like, if you're doing bonsai, you're going to notice when you have flower buds and when they bloom, like, regardless of whether it's a 3-inch azalea flower or, like, a teeny tiny little holly flower, like, you're going to notice. So I think it's just the language for the general populace versus the person who's actively looking at their tree multiple times a day, every single day for 35, 40 years.
Yeah. And so even like I mentioned it way earlier, it was the Japanese boxwoods. We work with those here and they're currently flowering. But
they stink.
Now, that's something that is really... Okay, so I hear this about certain plants, like, because we get different environmental factors, so we never get to that point. I don't smell them. I mean, unless your smell... Because, like, it's like that whole thing is like... what's that thing where it's like a certain thing tastes like soap? Is it
the cilantro thing?
The cilantro thing. It's like that. Like, maybe some people pick up on... certain flower smells differently.
I wonder if you dislike cilantro, if you also dislike boxwood, or if it's the same gene.
I don't know. You know,
everyone weigh in.
Yeah, let us know in the Discord if you're in a best bud. If you can smell boxwood flowers, I've never really noticed it. I'm trying to think if there's a couple of trees that when I'm trimming their root systems, they smell like peanut butter to me. I feel like that's a boxwood.
Yeah, that's a I don't know if it's boxwood, but I know there are trees that do smell like peanut butter.
Yeah, it's weird. Sometimes you trim certain trees and it's like, that smells very familiar. It has like a weird, or like junipers, they have like a minty fresh smell to them when they're being handled.
You mean cat pee?
Or Yeah. There's so many different ways to go about it. It's like when I work with like a lantana and you can just smell. See, like I enjoy that smell and you don't.
It smells terrible.
Okay. Maybe I'm on this different herbaceous journey than you are. And
probably
things smell better to me. And I have an acquired taste for some of these smells or something. But anyway, the Japanese boxwood flower, I didn't know for a long time until I started developing them and getting the refinement. And I started laying out the branches nice and fine. And I started spacing out all my nodes and, you know, really doing that whole thing where it's like you thin out the leaves and you can actually see the twiggy branches. Mm-hmm. And then those flowers go in into that space. And they actually have these little tiny white tipped on their green bud looking flower bases. Mm-hmm. It's like a big ovary part. And it's interesting to me because I'm like, that's still kind of like a showy flower. And even on Kingsville boxwoods, it's more obvious. Mm-hmm. They actually look like they're flowering like a full flush.
Yeah. The Taiwanese boxwoods smell less bad and are pretty prolific with flowering.
Yeah. The Taiwanese, there was another name for them, right? They got like the deep fissured bark.
Yeah. It's like a corky.
Well,
like
there's
cork.
The holly, the Harlandia. Is that
I'm
the
not
one?
Familiar. I don't know.
Because Harlandia, I think might be another common. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys in like Discord or comments or whatever. But Harlandia is another boxwood variety. It might be the same one we're talking about. It has the flower show is actually very obvious on it. It's like a bunch of little white flowers all over it.
Yeah.
So that's one thing to kind of look at with them too, is when they flower, can you actually show it and make that a little bit more unique? That's why I was mentioning with pine trees, when they make their pollinators, Japanese black pine, it looks like a little orangey puff of a showy little thing going on. That actually can be interesting. I know it's not something that I've never really seen people put like a Japanese black pine in a bonsai show with the pollinators on there and be like, look at the cones all over this. Isn't it beautiful?
Mm-hmm. I think
that's
probably
kind of
generally because they end up getting cut off.
Yeah, they will.
You know, just based on how people grow black pine or usually cut. But there'll be times during the year when I was back in Portland where I'd be moving a juniper and you set it down and it just emits this kind of puff of yellow. There's so many pollen cones on it. You're like, it's funny.
Is there, it might be just more of a cultural thing with certain plants where it's like you said, like most time those cones get just trimmed off, and also it has to attribute to horticultural technique of the way that they are pruned, because if you look at those pollinators, I think I asked Jonas about this too like a long time ago, and he said that it almost has no effect with the pollinators. Mm-hmm. Like they're just there.
Yeah,
so it does come down to just like an aesthetic thing almost. It's like, well, I just removed them because,
well, and a lot of times you know they're, it's the wrong time of year to be showing, you know, in spring or summer when they're doing their pollen thing. We don't always see the cones, especially on a conifer, because usually that's June, July thing.
I'll have to see if anyone's, I don't know. Have you seen like a conifer in display where they purposely were showing off that kind of thing?
No. Just because of time of year, mostly. I have seen trees that have had like seed cones left on them, one or two of them, just because it's, you know, interesting.
I guess I'm just more into the whole process then, because I wouldn't mind looking at a tree for instance, my huckleberries that I'm currently raising. I've got the full flush of flowers on them, and then I'm debating whether or not, because it might line up with, say, bonsai, that I think after a month's time, I don't know how long this flowering process is going to happen, that they will start producing their actual berries because they're a blueberry type plant. And I might need to cover them with like little netting to keep the birds off. I don't know yet how I'm going to combat that, because it's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. Birds frequent my yard, blue jays especially there. There's a flock of them. When we had our chickens, mm-hmm. and we had the seed, I had a family of bluebirds that would just be in my backyard nonstop. Mm-hmm. So it was nice, but I've heard that they're problematic birds sometimes. People don't
like
them.
They can be.
Yeah.
They're loud.
they're loud and they poo everywhere. So we have big old giant globs everywhere on my bonsai benches. And sometimes just all my branches, it's kind of just insane because they visit my trees quite a bit. I think they're still looking around for whatever remnants of my my chicken coop it might have been. But that's one of the things I'm like, how do I get the huckleberries to show flowers? And then I'm trying to like, if I get them to fruit, but the fruit might not be mature enough. It's just like that whole struggle. It's like, how do you go about that? You know, like with the hollies,
you just have to wait and see. And once you learn what it will do and how much it'll produce, then you can kind of gauge it a little bit better. But hopefully, I don't know if huckleberries, I don't know their situation. I don't know if they're separate male female plants or separate male female flowers, or if it's all in one. So hopefully you do get berries. And I mean, personally, I still like to see a tree with berries on it, even if they're not fully ripe, because, you know, it's that whole ephemeral thing of like, it's a very specific stage and it might not be ripe, but even just kind of watching it turn is really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of why I do bonsai in the first place, is because I get to see these little tiny processes happening with the flower to fruit stage. And I think with the huckleberries, I'll be fine, because literally in my front yard, there are wild huckleberries just kind of growing in the ground. They're a native plant. So that's that's one of the things that I kind of look at whenever I consider working with certain trees, is the availability of native. So you don't have to try so hard. So, but when you had the Ilex serrata and the other one that you mentioned,
Verticillata.
So what were those two hollies? The serrata is the Japanese, right?
I think so. And then the Verticillata, that's one of our native ones up north. It's the winterberry.
Winterberry, because I saw that one was compared to the possum haw, and possum haw is really interesting, because it's actually I think it's just the southern version of that other species.
Yeah.
The winterberry, it's just adapted and evolved slightly down here for more humid, wetter environments, and which makes it great, because then I'll probably get the same growth habits and same formations out of it that you could see in other deciduous holly habits. But it's called possum haw because possums, or opossums, whatever, possums value their fruits, that they actually got the nickname from that.
Really?
Yeah. So
that's kind of cute.
Yeah. Cause like, there's another native grape here called coon grape, and it's called raccoons like to eat their grapes often. But yeah, just like little nice things to know about interaction with environment. Some plants are named for the sake that they interact with certain animals or insects like that. So I thought that was really cool.
Well, one thing you bring up here too is really interesting. We could probably do a whole other episode about it, but like the environmental factors that make plants flower. So like you were saying that the possum haw is essentially just a verticillata that's southern. And you know, one of the things about a lot of these deciduous flowering plants that, you know, one of the reasons you struggle with azaleas down there is because you don't have that cold period. And so, like, I wonder if our verticillata needs, I don't know this specifically, but like, I don't know if it needs that cold period versus, you know, your possum haw that maybe doesn't need that, or if it would be okay with a longer cold period. But so, this needing of a cold period is called vernalization. And the plants have to acquire a certain amount of time at a certain cool temperature before they will flower. So this prevents them from flowering, you know, when it's still the middle of winter. But it also it keeps them, it essentially protects them. So they have to have a certain amount of time at that cold before they're like, okay, it can be spring now. And so that's one of the environmental factors that will, affect your amount of flowering. And it's one of the reasons you can force things a little bit earlier. So like our stuff in a cold frame is probably going to, you know, start growing earlier because it's going to be a little bit warmer, but they still do require X amount of time below X temperature before they're going to do that. Temperature is one thing that can control flowering. Day lengths, you know, that's another really big one.
It triggers just like dormancy and every plant. Yeah.
Yeah. It triggers dormancy, but it also triggers flowering. So there's short day plants, long day plants, and day neutral plants. So like short day plants, they only need, they need a smaller amount of light to bloom. So think poinsettia, think Christmas cactus, think, you know, that kind of stuff. Whereas the long day plants are more of your summertime plants. And as the day length changes, you know, that's the other thing that signals not just like, you know, springtime leaf growing, root growing, but also flowering. So like we used to grow poinsettias at work for the holiday display. Now we just mostly buy them in, but we would force them by giving them short days. So, you know, we would just cut them off from light at 4 o'clock instead of letting them have light until sunset. And you have to do that for a certain amount of time, but then they'll be like, oh, okay, now I'll change color and bloom. So changing day length, if you want to force something into bloom outside of its regular timing in nature, you can do that with correct temperature fluctuations and knowing whether it needs short days or long days, or like in the day neutral case, it doesn't matter. The light amount doesn't matter. It's more, there are other reasons why it will flower or not. So it's really fun to play with that. Easter lilies are another good one for day length and temperature.
That's interesting because it makes me think more like controlling those temperatures and everything. You can, I mean, it's, I think it'd be a little bit more difficult to control flowering in a way, right? I mean, because you said you're even still struggling, not struggling necessarily, but the azaleas in your cold frame are pushing ahead. They're going to start doing their thing because they...
Yeah, they're pushing out a little bit of growth. The flowers, you know, are still really slow and we can slow that down. Like if it gets to a point, you know, we can stick them in a refrigerator, bonsai refrigerator. And like, you know, not for long, but it's like at a florist, you know, like they have coolers. And so... they keep all their flowers in a cooler, which just slows down that process until they can be taken home or used or whatever. So if you have the ability to slow it down, you can. But also, you know, if our azaleas aren't blooming in time for a show, we pull them into the greenhouse and push them with higher temperatures and more light. And they're like, ah. And, you know, there's certain other plants that you give them more heat and their flowering period just is over so fast versus if it's a cool spring or whatever and they just kind of linger around. So generally, it's not something you see a lot of people in bonsai doing, forcing things or holding things back. But generally, with probably something like an azalea is what you would generally mostly do that with in bonsai, I think. Trying to think of other really big spring bloomers. You could do it with apples and stuff like that, but or cherries. But yeah, there's not as much forcing of flowering or the need to control it as there is in the horticultural industry, but it can be done, which is really, really fascinating and fun to play with.
So in a way, we can pressure plants into flowering and slow them down, but they're inevitably it's going to happen. There's no way to stop growth on trees regardless anyway, because that's just part
right.
of there.
It will happen, yeah, unless you damage it.
If you damage it, that becomes the unhealthy part of the tree.
Yeah, but then it'll still regrow unless you kill it. So
yeah, that kind of brings me to a kind of a point that kind of goes beyond this conversation a little bit on that, you know, is if anyone ever asks me about when their bonsai is growing, you know, they're like, what do I do whenever it grows? And I'm like, if it's growing, that means that that's the way things are supposed to happen. If your tree is not actively growing, something's wrong. And so it kind of comes back around to that. It's like the tree, if it's going to flower, things will go right. But there's also the way that you prune them. This is just an extra thing that we get from pruning practices or from different times of the year or different, you know, Yeah, it's a process that's going to happen depending on pruning methods and like opportunities, like you said, like long day and plants that will flower in low light situations too. So,
Well, like your maples are a really interesting example of that, because you don't think of like a Japanese maple as like a showy flowering tree, but if you don't do a whole ton of pruning on your tree in the fall, you're going to see a lot of flowers in the spring. But if you do a lot of pruning on your maple in the fall, you're going to see fewer or none, or, you know, it's just a different level of the, you don't think of, yeah, I mean, I had never thought of them as like a beautiful spring flower until I started seeing mature vine maples and mature Japanese maples that
with flowers all over
hadn't been pruned. And it's like, oh, wow, it's like a beautiful cloud of little tiny bells. It's very nice. But yeah, like the red maple you just posted, that's heavily in development, that was heavily pruned. It's got one little flower on it from a bud that didn't get cut off.
So it tells me, go ahead.
I was just going to say, as it matures and has more branches and more ramification and you don't need to cut as much, you're going to see more and more flowers on it.
That's what I was at. Yeah, that's where I was going to go, is like, eventually we will get enough mature branching and the less and less of the requirement to have to prune all the time. And that is a practice that I'm trying to apply more and more, is prune less and only selectively prune on certain trees. And so, I mean, every tree needs a reset. It's going to have to be pruned back every year, but learning how to regulate fertilizer types and like the percentages in your fertilizer, and then learning when to prune, has led to the process of flower production easier, and it comes more naturally because it is natural. And when you get that mature habit, those things will happen easier and more frequently. So it kind of goes hand in hand with like what I was mentioning. It's like, if your tree's growing, it's inevitably going to do X. And that's either extend buds, harden off branches, create roots. And then in turn, once that mature habit is there, then the flowers will come. But then there's like trees that just keep flowering, like we mentioned like earlier, like the crepe myrtle, you cut the flowers off, they keep going and going. So
that's a good example of like new flowers on new growth, something that's just kind of continuously going and you can't really stop it even if you tried.
Yeah. And that's the funny thing with like, so you had mentioned earlier, it's like pine trees get pruned a certain way, so we don't see those pollinators a lot. And with crepe myrtles, you can let crepe myrtles grow out to a certain extent where the flowers become a feature. But because of the way we have to prune them in order to control their growth, flowers are actually harder to pull off convincingly on a crepe myrtle.
Yeah.
So you could do something like prune it back to its silhouette nice and tight and get that refinement stage going. But you have to let one of the new growth pieces go long, so you might blow it out from the inside of the structure of the tree, so that depending on the length of that bloom, will it hit the exterior of that silhouette and look convincing. And I was looking at I watch YouTube a lot, and I watch like recaps of shows and stuff. Like, I'm that huge of a dork when it comes to bonsai stuff, and I'll sit there and I'll watch, like, Rory will take a nap and I'll just turn on a YouTube video of bonsai trees at a show. And I was noticing that there are some times that they'll prepare a tree for show and they'll purposely prune back nice and hard and get their mature branching shapes. And then some of the trees, like a cherry or roses, some rose types that they'll use in Japan or in other countries that we just don't really get to see too much. They will leave those longer shoots of that new growth, that they know that the internode spacing on that flower won't be too horrible. It won't look too crazy, that you still get to enjoy the flowers on that plant to a certain extent. And that's very tricky to pull off in bonsai display. So that was one of the things I was kind of observing. I was watching the recap of, can't remember if it was the trophy or if it was like another show that was recent. It was this year. I noticed that. I was like, oh, that tree, the branching on that tree looks great, but at the compromise of the flowers, they let some of these kind of more wiry branches kind of stick out with the little flower developments on the end. So
yeah, it looks, it's kind of that kind of, that silly look, like having a full size quince fruit on a quince. You know, it's like it doesn't like necessarily look right, but it's very interesting to look at.
Yeah. And sometimes they get away with like putting one or leaving, not putting, but leaving one quince on a entire tree, and it's just massive. And then you have this scaled down proportion tree. So,
you know what blooms regularly, really well, reliably all the time? Can't, you know, it's just, it's,
can't stop it.
It's always blooming all the time. You never have to worry about the scale of it or cutting off the flower buds. Chojubai.
I was gonna guess quince. Most quince we have scarlet red, Texas scarlet red quince.
It's pretty good one.
Yeah, and that's one that does well here. The chojubai here, I'm finding that they are a little bit trickier than I had assumed. So yeah, that's unfortunate. But yeah,
they are both the easiest and the hardest plant to grow.
Yeah, the scarlet red is tough, and it deals with crappier soil conditions, and that's what I found. And those, I mean, we had them, it snowed here and those were flowering, and then it got warm and it started flowering again because the flowers burned off, and then it got cold again, the flowers burned off, and now flower buds are back. And so yeah, like they're continuously just popping flower buds out of the same locations over and over again.
My chojubai is, it all it needs is a couple warm days and it's gonna just explode. It's gonna be lovely.
So I think that's a lot of,
That was a lot.
That's a lot of information on like flowers and, you know, happy spring kind of topic there. Just kind of, you know, kind of setting us up for, but yeah, no, I was going to say with the thing with flowering too, is like, I've told a lot of people with like, for instance, with say bonsai, that a lot of people are like, oh man, that's a hard time to show bonsai trees because that's not typical. Typically, shows are later in the year to equate for repotting, going into that first flush, being able to prune and get everything set up from recovery of the wintertime. But there, I don't know if there's enough springtime shows to really exhibit that process and what would you say, like the...
Just the whole,
transposing. I don't know. I'm trying to think of a way to explain it. Like, it's that changeover from dormant to new things happening. And that a lot of that brings flowers that we don't get to see otherwise in shows. I don't know.
Yeah. Shows are generally so, you know, everything has to be really tight and formal and nice. And those are lovely, but it is fun to kind of see the wildness of the springtime, and it's just a stage you don't always get to witness. And so it's kind of fun to do a show at the wrong time so that you can see some of that stuff. As you know, it's like, I feel like you got to go into it anticipating that like you're going to see some stuff that maybe you normally wouldn't expect in a show because of the time of year, but that's part of the joy of it.
Yeah.
So,
but yeah, that's the thing with being here. Is that like we were discussing that the spring here is so weird that a lot of my trees are already starting to bud out. In fact, I have a bald cypress that I repotted before the snow, and then I had to bring it in, of course, during the snow. And then it's got full, it's like fully fleshed out now.
Wow.
The leaves are extending out, and by say bonsai in a month, that's already gonna be ready to go, you know? So it's that whole, you know, when is the appropriate time to show? And I think I did it on accident. I like when I said like, oh, I have a show in March, and everybody's like, that's a weird time for a bonsai show. And I'm starting to realize as I get further into this, because I started out bonsai nurseryman. Now I've taken up a lot of like experiences into going and showing trees and stuff. And so I know I made a goofy time of year to do it, but maybe it gives us an opportunity to show the other processes that we kind of talked about in this episode, is not just the flowering, but the other things that set up the, like you said, like how hollies have the buds, the flower buds before they even come out, they have a unique look to them. So,
There's trees that I only show I put out on display at the gardens when they're pushing buds or when they are losing leaves or don't have leaves. Like, most of the summer season, they're not really showable because of leaf size, but the way their buds extend or because of how they flower, it's really interesting. I'm thinking like American hornbeam, you know, they've got such big leaves, but when they're extending, they're so pretty.
Oh, they're
so
beautiful.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, that's the kind of thing that you could really pick and choose for a show this time of year, what it is you're going to have. And if you have to defoliate, if you have to cut stuff back, like it's that's the time of year. So I think just embrace it. And if your tree's wild, like, cool.
I think it's interesting that you said American hornbeam has a big leaf. It can, in my opinion.
The couple that we have in the collection up here have a very big leaf at the moment. Yes.
Okay.
Is, I know that's not every American hornbeam, but it might just be this particular genotype from these that were collected in this particular area. I mean, I've got two of them. Beyond those two, I don't have a huge range of knowledge of American hornbeam. So,
oh yeah, I love this species, and I think that's something that I would like to kind of lead us into our next episode. We're not going to record it now, obviously, but I think I want to go into our next episode talking about first flush, and then also talking about leaf size. I've heard other people and other professionals talk about leaf size, and they're like, oh, the leaves on this tree are so big. And I think that's a topic that I really want to kind of discuss, or, you know, back and forth with you about it too.
Oh yeah.
Somebody who's in a public garden collection, type situation. It's like you said, like these leaves are too big, so I don't like showing it like that. And then we want to talk about the perspective of large leaves, bad thing, ? Like my Acer rubrums that I'm currently developing, we know that Acer rubrums can get massive leaves, but there's a certain charm and a certain way to approach. There's a charm to the way that those leaves can look if they're big, and there's a way to manage it. You know, sweet gums, American hornbeams, American elms, different species that just have big, big leaves on them. I would like to go into that and talk about what is the limitations on big leaves. And there's another species even in the tropicals, like the sea grape. You've seen those, I'm sure. And
Sea
grapes,
even ficus. I mean, they can get huge leaves if they're
some ficuses. Yeah,
yeah.
Microcarpa with all of its different variants, you know. But like the sea hibiscus has this giant, round, goofy looking leaf on it, but it's used seriously in the Florida scene as a serious bonsai tree. You know, people are not joking around when they're like, oh, this tree looks like it's got a bunch of little balloons on it, because they're like literally circular, just perked up leaves. But there is a look, there's an aesthetic. And I think we should talk about that. That would be really cool. So
I think so, too. Yeah. Yeah.
We'll revisit that one.
I love talking about leaf size. So,
yeah, let's cover that on the next one. Yeah.
OK, so, perfect.
Yeah. So thank you guys for listening to our show. We're going to go ahead and spout off our Bonsai Best Buds real quick, and we're going to wrap it up and do all the shout outs that we normally do at the end of the show. So starting off our list with no particular order of favorites or anything, which we don't choose favorites here, but Wallace Woods Pottery, Bonsai Samurai, Radtron Roost Studio, Wesley Thompson, Joseph Domingue, David Smith, Eddie Fernandez, Bonsai Myrick Bonsai Pottery, Chantel Wynn, Hist Warrior, Christina Carforia, David J. Bacchettini, Gilbert Juarez, Sean Seaman, J.M. Stewart Woodworking, Joshua Roth Limited, Nancy Hoffman, Nate Murray, Ben Crean, Victorina Ridgeway, Timothy Arsenal, Chris Fossoon, Joss Potts. I'm just going to say it that way.
J.A.S.
Bonsai Marine, A.C. Castle, Luis Torres, Austin Atkins, David N., Chase, Taylor Peacock, Greenwich Gardens, Backyard Bonsai Australia, Justin Knight, Joel Jenkins, It's Not Delivery, It's Ryan DiGiorno, Snappy Shappers, Joshua Bentley, Dricky Ruins, Boyd Snowgrove, Vicky Auth, Mark Malatai, Draco, Micah Rouse, Joseph DiGiorno, Kathy Barbazon, this Patreon told me that this isn't the name that their Patreon gave them on accident, but I'm going to keep going with it. FTNRFN, David Thal, DK, Rico, and Jeremy. Thank you guys so much for sponsoring our show. And of course we have our Specimen Best Buds on Raw UN Bonsai Garden Australia, through Rick. And then we have Mark McWilliams, J. David Tolbert, and of course Bill Butler as the anchor Specimen Best Bud of our show. and Josh Roth Tools as our main show sponsor. And then if you guys want to go over to YouTube and check out more of my stuff, I've been doing a lot of YouTube videos recently about anything and everything. I've been trying to do like a catalog of bald cypress spit videos. So I have like how to wire, how to prune, how to repot. I have like a video that's about to come out this week where I take a bald cypress out of my grow field and I cut it in half and split it like a banana and use it like two trees instead of one.
A banana split.
And I even put like a little scoop of ice cream in the middle. And
sprinkles?
Yeah, and sprinkles on it. I sprinkle sphagnum moss on top of it.
It's perfect. Delicious.
Yeah. And then we also have underhillbonesai.com. There's some articles that I wrote. I'm working on a few more articles. Trust me, they'll be there. I know I say that. And then sometimes I have like five articles release all at one time and then I don't do anything for a little while, but that's just the way things work. And then you go over to Instagram and Facebook and follow us there as well. And then for Mike Lane, you can go over to ketsunebonsai.com and check out what he offers, where his classes and stuff will be. I don't know if he's got any events coming up, but I'm sure you can check it on his socials. He will be at Say Bonsai with us, so you can see him there. And then for Carmen, where do they check out your stuff at?
You can find me on Facebook and Instagram and Blue Sky at Becoming Bonsai. And be sure to check out the Purple Pot Society, the National Women's Bonsai Group that works to encourage women to get more involved in bonsai. But you don't have to be a woman to join. We're open to everybody.
Yep. I am a member of the Purple Pot Society. So, So make sure you support women in bonsai. Thanks for hanging out with us, guys, on this one. I think we already have our topic for next week. So we'll talk about big leaves next week. It'll be
big
fun.
Big leaves.
And I cannot lie. I like big leaves. So you guys have a great week.
Bye. That was a weird one.